Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight, we have a panel discussion presented by the Center for the Study of Europe in collaboration with the Latin America Studies Program. Our speakers are Costas Cornetis, assistant professor at the Center for European and Mediterranean Studies at New York University, and Alex Kosnovich, associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Tonight's discussion is titled Social Resistance in Times of Austerity. We begin with an introduction by Cornel Bam, assistant professor of international relations at Boston University.
This conversation comes in a context in which there is an emerging consensus, basically, that austerity doesn't work and it's a nightmare for both politics and economics. And also there is increasing evidence that extended periods of austerity, by which we mean cutting government spending to accommodate largely creditors of sovereign states, is associated with a high degree of political volatility. Usually the status quo collapses. There is, you know, even quantitative scholars have showed how this is the case. You know, looking over 60 years, the political order that starts austerity programs, if they last for a very long time, it doesn't last very long. At best, it is confronted with very challenging political and the civic movements. And those movements don't necessarily have to be of the kind of emancipatory left-leaning orientation. They could be of the kind of radical right variety, and we have seen that historically since modern capitalism came on stage. Now, we are not going to talk about the far right tonight. We are going to talk about the sort of radical imagination of the left here. And our speakers will engage with the issue of the radical imagination in hard times on both sides of the Atlantic. From the old world comes Costis Cornetis, teaching here at an assistant professor at NYU. His recent book, The Children of the Dictatorship, Student Resistance, Cultural Politics, and the Long 60s in Greece, engages with what I think is a very cool topic, you know, not only the decadence and the ultimate collapse of the power of the colonels in Greece in the early 1970s, but also as an extension in a slew of articles on Spain in particular, looking at how the way in which these regimes collapsed and the kind of imagination that the collapse generated among a variety of publics influences the way in which people protest today against austerity, right? Because in Southern Europe, there was a certain transition deal. That deal seems to be broken. It is perceived to be a broken deal by the people, right? There is a backlash against that, and Costis has looked at how this played out in both Spain and Greece. So some of the oldest parts of the old world will be represented there at length. Now, from the new world, both, you know, the North American and Latin American side of the story comes Alexis Kosnovich. He is an associate professor of sociology and anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University of Halifax, Nova Scotia. His work has focused extensively on radical, militant, militarized protest against the state in Mexico in the form of the well-known Zapatista movement. He has published two books on this topic. And hot off the press, I'm burning here, The Radical Imagination, Max Heaven and Alex Kosnovich, engaging more with the sort of north side of the border. What I think brings Costis and Alex together is not just this interest in austerity and protest, but, you know, the kind of protests they are looking at are not localized protests. They are not some kind of parochial Greek protest in the middle of nowhere. They are all parts of some global wave, right? Whether we're looking at the wave that started with, you know, the Bay Declaration in California in the late 60s and sort of was replicated in the May 68 in Paris and reaching its climax in a very sort of localized way in the form of the Greek student movement against dictatorship in Spain. And likewise, Alex is looking at the Zapatistas and how their imagination shaped a certain anti-neoliberal set of protests in many settings, in North America and Europe and so on and so forth. Because I think what makes this moment very special is that these kind of protests were certainly anti-authoritarian. There is an increasing association of austerity with the decay of democracy, and even in its modest liberal parliamentary form. And therefore, I think the lessons that the Greek students and the Spanish students in your larger work and the lessons of the Zapatistas' insurgency in the 90s and 2000s are quite relevant for what kind of politics will emerge from the confrontation between this kind of semi-authoritarian or even authoritarian politics of austerity and the kind of citizen understanding of what their choices are, right? Your message is that there are choices, right? And there are smart ways of articulating that kind of politics. But I will stop here. I'm going to ask Kostis Kornetis to start this presentation. Kostis, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Cornel, for this great introduction. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very glad to be here tonight. So, social resistance in times of austerity. As I'm a historian, this paper focuses in particular on appropriations and reappropriations of the historical past and its political legacy in the present. So it's exactly as Cornel introduced it. I'm not a political scientist, but I'm just trying to look at the interaction between the past and the present and draw some conclusions. So in the context of increased popular talk about populist backlashes against austerity in Europe, and on the wake of the rise of far-right parties throughout Europe, Spain and Greece seem to be the exception to the rule, not because there is no right-wing populism or rising extreme right, of course, as we know, but because in both countries, popular movements from below molded into left-wing political parties that challenge the establishment for the first time since the inauguration of democracy. In order to gain a better understanding of the popular appeal of these left-leaning political formations in the two countries, in particular Podemos in Spain and Syriza in Greece, both important players in the respective countries' opposition, we have to go back to a key moment, that is 2011, and the parallel appearance of two grassroots movements that shook the two countries to their foundations and whose consequences we still witness. So what happened in 2011? In Greece, since the onset of the economic crisis, people were experiencing the country's entrance to the EU-IMF mechanism of support, otherwise called the Troika, as a loss of national sovereignty. Austerity-induced policies affected not only the working class, but also the middle-income strata. The government's neoliberal policies and its spending cuts led also to the abrupt dismantling of the welfare state and a collapse of the social contract. And again, this is a social contract that was very much created right after the fall of the dictatorship in 1974. Wages and pensions across the public and private sector were slashed, while at the same time taxes were raised and more taxes were introduced and more cuts were introduced. In short, the welfare state was drastically dismantled. One could talk of a rapid disintegration of the social fabric as well. Many of the above characteristics, coupled with the skyrocketing of unemployment, especially youth unemployment, could be applied to Spain too. Of course, there is structural incongruence there. There is a relative time lag between the two crises. The fact that the country's economics were, well, Spain's economics were not placed directly under foreign control and so on. But the collective experience of society's disintegration and the growing conviction that the country's political personnel was inadequate, well, inadequate to say the least, obsolete, actually, were shared. And this intensified the emotions of anger and rage. It was in late spring and early summer of 2011 that these feelings found expression in these two mass movements from below. Effective mobilization in Spain and Greece, already underway, took inspiration from the Arab Spring, especially the sustained occupation of Tahrir Square in Cairo. This was the year of popular uprisings everywhere. Some people were quick, actually, to liken the synchronicity of these grassroots movements to the 1968 uprisings. Some people also talk of the analogy to the 1848 revolutions. The 15th of, well, this is from Life magazine, this famous cover of the person of the year for 2011, and the person of the year was the protester. And this is from inside the magazine. And here on the left, there is a protester from Greece. So in May of 2011, and after multiple call-outs in the Spanish social media, especially on Facebook, calling on people to protest peacefully without holding any party or flags or banners, the Spanish Indignados occupied the squares Puerta del Sol in Madrid and the Plaza de Catalunya in Barcelona. In late May 2011, similar call-outs appeared in Greek social media with people claiming that the Spanish protesters in Puerta del Sol actually held banners with the sarcastic slogans, "Silence or we will awaken the Greeks." So just as in Spain, in Greece too, protesters took out to the central squares and decided to remain there overnight, turning this event to a long-term encampment. Protesters mobilized against official political institutions, they challenged financial capitalism, espoused the principle of solidarity, and demanded, of course, radical political change. Spanish and Greek indignados did not only protest against government cuts, but also against the lack of political representation. They came together directly as equal citizens, not only as members of identity groups or through representatives, to debate the fallacies of current policies. The Indignados movements offered something new that increased the involvement of large groups of previously demobilized citizens. They adopted organizational strategies commonly associated with the autonomous movements, with alternative movements, which are keen on non-hierarchical, horizontal, participatory understandings of involvement that depart from formal organizations and defined notions of leadership and representative modes of action. This mode of organization acquired great resonance since it was hitherto limited to much less visible networks of activism and very goal-specific activism in the past. Direct democracy seemed to be functioning for a while, at least, and made ordinary citizens feel more involved and more politicized, shaping an entire generation of young participants. And I'm saying this because the vast majority of the occupiers were between 25 and 44 years old. So this was a formative experience in terms of collective nonviolent action. It was what we could call a new mental structure. It provided a new mental structure. A Spanish female student noted, I quote, "I have learned more during those 40 days than during many years within the educational system," end of quote. So the summer of 2011 was a moment of politicization, a rite of initiation, and a springboard for the emergence of a new political subjectivity. But how new were, in fact, the materials that constituted this political subjectivity? Many activists in the square movements had ambivalent attitudes towards the past and its political legacy. The past, in particular the memory of past social movements, is the lens used by the media to analyze and represent every movement, as Jill Eddy had argued. However, what is noteworthy in the case of social resistance against austerity is that these movements themselves participated in the construction of this lens, choosing strategically, I argue, the representation of the past that was more useful to their goals. What we should single out here, among other factors, is the commemorability of an event, the mnemonic capacity of a movement, the resonance in the audience produced by the chosen commemorative form. All this provides the base for an analytical model aiming to explain why and how specific events from the past have success in being socially remembered. What I find fascinating about the Indignados is the persistent, consistent, and systematic way in which they used direct interpolations of the 1970s in particular in their discourse. Of course, a movement can adopt old symbols traditionally far from its own identity and charge them with new meanings. Likewise, an episode from the past can become a part of a new narrative. An analysis of these mechanisms could be very useful for understanding how the relationship between social movements and collective memory work, showing the results of the movement's work as mnemonic agents and the consequence of this process on the symbolic construction of contemporary conflict. The 2011 protest movements in Greece and Spain acted as mnemonic agents, manipulating the past, as I said, for their own cause, and at times revising or even correcting it. They both challenged the hegemonic representation of their antecedents, as reported by the media, or distanced themselves from them. One of the major slogans that were voiced in the Greek indignados rallies, for example, was that the junta is the standard way of referring to the colonel's dictatorship that lasted from 67 to 74, an extremely conservative, nationalistic, anti-communist regime. According to the slogan, the junta did not end in 1973, thus stressing the issue of continuity between the authoritarian past and the disruptive present. By making a temporal jump, the slogan in question implied that after the restoration of democracy, the new regime was equally authoritarian to the previous one. Repression did not cease to exist. The repressive state apparatus, as Louis Althusser used to call it, remained intact. Interestingly, this slogan got the dates wrong, as the Greek colonel's junta collapsed in 74 and not 73. Some people said that this was for the sake of rhyme, because it rhymes this way. But beyond that argument, the wrong date reverberates a deeply imprinted conviction in Greek collective memory, especially among the young, that the student uprising of the Athens Polytechnic in November of 1973, and you can see here a typical image, actually brought down the colonels. A conviction, of course, that is inaccurate, as the junta decided to transfer power to the politicians for largely unrelated reasons, mainly connected to the Cyprus question. Now, my book that Cornell introduced is about, of course, precisely this incident and its evident long-lasting effect, well, what we can call its afterlives in Greek political culture. But what's interesting is that a slogan becomes powerful through repetition. So in 2011, and in the height of the economic crisis, this slogan, which actually used to be an anarchist slogan, went mainstream, and it was adopted by Indignados, a mass movement. It first appeared in a huge banner, with the one that I showed you in front of the Greek parliament on Syntagma Square, but then it started being widely chanted. It also retained its sound pattern intact, despite the fact that it was slightly revised for the needs of the moment. There is a certain revisionism that is interesting to note here. For the people chanting this slogan, the story of the Greek transition to democracy was not half as rosy as it used to be portrayed until very recently by textbooks and the like. In a way, thus, the Indignados challenge a major given in the collective and public memory regarding the democratic transition, challenging in a way also the standard periodization of events. Spanish indignados were also involved in a radical reconceptualization of the past. The 70s themselves became an issue of open contestation, not so much the Civil War or the Francoist period, as was the case in previous social movements in that country. Capitalizing on the so-called myth of the transition, the new generation of protesters rejecting this most well-known and widely accepted topos that shaped the hegemonic memory of the country and one of the foundational myths of Spanish democracy. Most indignados are adamant about the transition gone astray. The model transition is now seen not only as a means of deceit on behalf of the authorities, but as an entire intergenerational betrayal, and I think the generational issue is very interesting there. In their narrative, the transition is presented as an unfinished business, as politicians lack the courage to tackle the thorny issues of the past head on. There has been no reckoning with this past, no closure. There is an open wound, in a way. So the rage regarding the treatment of the past goes as far as to claim that the death of Franco did not automatically mean the passage to a real democracy. And this is a typical slogan and catchword of the Spanish indignados, which is democracia real ya, you know, real democracy now. So there is somehow this utopian form of authentic democracy. Once again, slogans are central here. Several of them crucially refer to the famous televised statement by Prime Minister Carlos Arias Navarro on November the 20th, 75, announcing the death of the dictator. And the appeal went, Españoles, Franco ha muerto. Franco is dead, again, the foundational moment of the transición. So current versions in the Indignados include, especially, Franco ha vuelto, and which means Franco is back, or even Españoles la política ha muerto, or, you know, politics are dead. So in a way, they're subverting and correcting the original phrase. As French historian Pierre Nora famously wrote, the task of remembering makes everyone his own historian. And this is precisely, I argue, what young activists aspired to through this intellectual quest. Despite this rejection, however, there lurks a strong rapport between past and present. Apart from coming consistently under attack by the protagonists of contestation, the crucial decade of the 1970s also became a powerful source of inspiration. The 70s are present in all sorts of ways in social movement genealogies. The ways of conceptualizing violence, for example, the juxtaposition between past and present violent protest policing or general authoritarian practices became a powerful topos. In Greece, the typical slogan went, "We haven't seen so much democracy since the junta years." In Spain, typically you see juxtapositions of past moments of police coercion and present-day moments of police coercion. This is a typical image that circulated very much in the web. On the one side, you can see from 1976, a violent moment of protest policing in Barcelona right at the beginning of the transition. And this is from Valencia in 2012, very, very violent incidents and clashes between protesters and policemen. And the slogan goes, "History repeats itself." In an emblematic cartoon that circulated in the online edition of El Diario, entitled The Mysterious Spanish Black Hole, 74-2012, we see a very similar feeling of déjà vu, you know, the promotion of the idea that authoritarian residues persist, with police repression being a very important one. So in the cartoon, a tear gas canister is thrown by the police in the distant 1974, and it lands on the protesters in 2012. So, similarly, when the Spanish government in 2013 publicized its intention to resume using water cannons on protesters, people spoke of the revival of the very repressive modes of Francoism. Even the socialist spokesperson Soraya Rodríguez accused Rajoy of using the same repressive methods as Franco, even though, of course, water cannons had been used by the socialist government of Felipe González as late as 1987. But it doesn't matter. The images were circulated on the web, so once again, you know, linking the past with the present. What I'm trying to say here is that apart from all this, the 70s are not just evoked as a negative model. The legacy of the hitherto forgotten or delegitimized moments of protest history is revived. The 1970s Movimientos del Barrio in Spain, for instance, are definitely the most powerful precedent to the Indignados and its various reincarnations. There was this great moment in 2012 when, during a speech of the Prime Minister of the day, Pasos Coelho, in the parliament, it was a plenary session, many people who were in the balconies of the parlament, they started chanting "Grando la Villa Morena" by Zeca Afonso, which was the hymn of the Portuguese Revolution of 1974, making him stop and his talk and wait until the chanting finished. Similarly, in the summer of 2012 in Greece, when in an unconstitutional move the Greek government shut down the public television broadcast, the music that was endlessly heard in the spontaneous movement that was created against state authoritarianism was Mikis Theodorakis, the typical engagé poet chansonnier or composer of the 60s and 70s. So all this highlights this interesting mixture between past and present militancy. I see that this blending of the conceptual landscape of 75 and 78 with 2011. And so let me give you a last example. I believe that these new movements, they have inherited much of the new sensibilities that developed during the transition period in terms of contentious politics. These are just moments of present-day violence, and again, very, very typically juxtaposed to older moments of violence. This is from Greece, and this is from Spain, and once again, the big question is, how different is this from a real authoritarian regime? But I want to go back to this very, very central slogan, Democracia Real, yeah, and references to real democracy. Once again, I believe that this conceptual landscape to which this appeals to real or authentic forms of democracy refer to goes back to the 1970s. In November of 1976, a special issue of Ajo Blanco, and this is the cover, a very important countercultural magazine of 1970s Spain, was dedicated to the right to the city. The main article declared that, I quote, "If we want real democracy, democracia real, we have to provide variety, including the concept of the city walls. The walls belong to the citizens, to all those who have something to say. Clandestinity is over. Are we or are we not in a democracy?" End of quote. So collective participation in street politics was connected to real democracy in the distant 1976 as well. The whole question of what constitutes a real democracy, a democracia de verdad, and what not, was directly linked to the discourse on public spaces, the free circulation of ideas in squares, and the slogans written on the walls of the squares. In the words of one of the occupiers in 2011, I quote, "Citizens' peaceful invasion of public squares is a symbol of how public spaces can be regained and also of how real and deep politics can be made," end of quote. The similarities are striking. In this respect, I believe that the contention that the Indignados inaugurated modes of politicization that do not correspond to either old or new social movements is inaccurate. I believe that the nostalgic drive of re-legitimizing the contentious past runs parallel to the critical drive vis-a-vis the same delegitimized authoritarian past, privileging past scripts over present circumstances, or one step further, national historical narratives and local frames over international and contemporary ones. Finally, there is a certain performativity of the past as well. Performing the past or performing memory is an interesting issue because it is not only a means of appropriating that past, but of colonizing it as well. Now, Guillem Martinez, one of the writers of a seminal text called La Cultura de la Transición, a seminal text of the Indignados, because it circulated a lot in Spain, wonders at a certain point regarding the current situation, is there any future in all this past? Hay un futuro en todo este pasado. And I believe that his rhetoric question could be applied to this entire movement, despite their irrefutable innovative aspects. The past, I argue, resembles a prison. It seems impossible to escape it, despite all the efforts in this direction. And even though social movements are forward-looking, and I know that Alex has co-written this great book on radical imagination in the movements that allows us to envision the future, at times they also seem to be trapped in history. In any case, the creation of Podemos, a real heir of the squares, and its acquisition of 8% of the votes in the first participation in the recent Euro elections marked a radical change in Spanish politics and the definitive end of the bipartidismo. In Greece, on the other hand, what happened in the squares was canalized into several political formations. It has to be noted that even though the majority of demonstrators identified themselves as Democrats protesting against the current crisis of representation, searching for alternative models of democracy, the prevailing narratives constructed a political space that enabled the intrusion of extreme right political forces. The rightist populist party, Anexarteti Elines, Independent Greeks, and to some extent the neo-Nazi party Golden Dawn, took advantage of the momentum of the squares. Still, the most important receiver of political support was Syriza, a party that symbolizes hope. And despite everything and all possible drawbacks, the emergence of these movements must be seen as a remarkable disruption of the existing patterns of political culture, offering something new that helped the involvement of large groups of
previously demobilized citizens. I want to conclude with a quote by Spanish theorist Ofelia Ferran, who rightly predicted many years ago that, I quote, "those aspects of the past that had tried to be forgotten, repressed, will inevitably return, and they will function as lapses in syntax, resistances to the official historical narratives that explain the past away. This time is now, as the crisis acted as the catalyst for what we could call the revival of the repressed, seriously undermining the standard frames of recent history. However, the multiple temporalities that point back to the 70s or the 40s rendered these decades repressive points of reference that is impossible to escape, even if, or maybe precisely because, these movements supposedly reject their political legacy." Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justis. Alex, you have the floor.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. Thanks to Elizabeth and Cornell, especially, for inviting me and for putting on such a great event. And thanks to Costis for such an interesting presentation. I aim to follow it up with something maybe a little bit different. So, well, this is interesting, I think, because, and I don't want to make too much of the disciplinary differences, perhaps, but perhaps my talk will be more anthropological. I'm not sure. Sometimes I'm not really sure what the anthropology of social movements ought to look like, but maybe we'll see some interesting resonances as well here. As the introduction, I think, fairly accurately described, I'm going to talk about movements more on the side of the Atlantic, and really specifically in what Max and I call in our book the Anglophone North Atlantic, because we're trying to be more attentive, perhaps, to the differences in context than I've been in some of my previous work, when I was interested in the resonance of Zapatismo beyond its originating context amongst diverse communities of activists in Canada and the United States specifically, but of course in Mexico as well. So my comments tonight touch on Zapatismo, but they also have more to do with this idea of the radical imagination as it operates in movements today. In many ways, not so different than the prison that memory can be. I'm not really sure that... while Max and I would certainly argue that there are liberatory potentials and that radical movements are inspired by radical imagination, that's not a guarantee. There are no guarantees with respect to that, that we have an awful lot at stake before us and a lot of work to do if we want to make that so. I just want to say that, borrowing from my friend and co-traveler Chris Dixon, that you will see my lips moving up here, but the words that I'm going to convey to you are not solely my own. They belong in part to Max Haven, who's my co-author and the co-director of the Radical Imagination Project, but much more so, they belong to the people over the last 10 years, but specifically over the last four in Halifax, who have taken their time and shared their insights with us. And certainly, if any of this makes any sense, and I hope it does, that credit should belong to them, that we are sort of caretakers of this and not originators. So, Patrick Rainsborough, an activist whose work focuses on the power of meaning-making and struggles for social change, describes our current conjuncture not simply as the age of austerity, but as that of the slow-motion apocalypse. Situated against the horizon of the ecological endgame driven by global capitalism and industrial civilization, Rainsborough's explanation of the slow-motion apocalypse is not another recapitulation of an end-is-nigh catastrophism that so preoccupies the popular imagination today. Describing the slow-motion apocalypse as, quote, "the gradual unraveling of the routines, expectations, and institutions that comfort the privileged and define the status quo," end quote, Rainsborough mines the Greek root of the word apocalypse and tells us that it literally means to, quote, "take the cover away, to reveal something that has not been seen," end quote. Rainsborough challenges us to understand the ways in which our attempts to make meaning out of the world buttress or challenge existing systems of domination and exploitation, and advance or inhibit grassroots alternative building. In advancing the potentially revelatory capacity of crisis, Rainsborough evokes the Marxist narrative of capitalism's internal crises setting the stage for proletarian revolution without the assurances that high modernist moments seem to offer. The challenges of the slow-motion apocalypse are far from merely technical or reform-based. They require a radical reimagining of what is possible and necessary socially, politically, and economically. In short, and in the words of author and organizer Harsha Walia, They call for mass movements animated by the radical imagination and capable of cultivating, quote, fierce, loving, and sustainable communities of resistance striving towards collective liberation, end quote. How do we measure the nonlinear effects of the circulation and resonance of a radical political imagination? Cognizant of the risks of romanticizing and commodifying radical struggles that always seem to be happening elsewhere, the radical imagination and its relationship to powerful and resilient social movements cannot be cynically reduced to them. My own academically based work with social movements coincided with my political radicalization, with both of them emerging out of the resonance of the Zapatista uprising in the context of my own life and political and intellectual trajectory. On the first day of the new year in 1994, several thousand indigenous Mayan insurgents, armed from 10 years of clandestine organizing and 5 centuries of resistance and persistence in the face of genocide, colonialism, and imperialism, declared war on the federal executive of the Mexican Republic and the Mexican army. In statements issued during those first days of the new year, the insurgents of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation declared that they'd risen up in arms not to seize the state, but to smash a corrupt, violent, and illegitimate system so that Mexicans could freely and democratically govern themselves. They called the North American Free Trade Agreement a, quote, death sentence for the indigenous peoples of Mexico. But more than a rebellion for or against a particular kind of economic model, the Zapatistas articulated the rationale for their uprising in terms of justice, dignity, liberty, and democracy. The Zapatista uprising did not topple the government of President Carlos Salinas, nor did it manage to defeat the Mexican army. But in many ways, the rebellion initiated by the Zapatistas would accomplish something as revolutionary and far less predictable as these goals. Indeed, as the dream of state-sponsored socialism lay for so many buried beneath the rubble of the Berlin Wall, what began as an armed uprising in the far southeast of Mexico would radically expand the horizon of political possibility on a global scale and spark a transnational direct action, anti-capitalist, radically democratic movement of movements for an alternative globalization. As I came to understand through my research with activists in Canada and the U.S., the Zapatistas' initiation of a protracted dialogue with dissidents on a global scale reshaped the very logic and ethic of radical political practice and possibility for many. Despite the important and provocative nature of the movement dynamics explored in the course of my research tracing the transnational resonance of Zapatismo, the project itself remained limited to archiving the life of a phenomenon that had already been at work in the world. In conversations I was having at the time with activists and engaged academics, we began to wonder what it would mean to try and make social movement research work in a way that went beyond cataloging what is to participate in bringing something into being. In August 2010, funded by Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council Standard Research Grant, a 4-person research team consisting of 2 research assistants from the local activist community, my project co-director, Max, and myself began the Radical Imagination Project in Halifax, Nova Scotia. The project's aim was to convoke the radical imagination, that is, to call something which is not yet fully present into being, in collaboration with activists self-identifying as radical. For us, the term radical names movements or approaches that understand the social problems that concern them to be irresolvable within the current political system, and so seek systemic change. As for the radical imagination, the capacity to project how the world might be otherwise, we've argued that the imagination is a collective process rather than an individualized thing, and that its wellspring is not the romanticized and fetishized image of the genius at work, but communities and collectives as they work their way through the world. In large part, the impetus for our project emerged from a set of troubling and unavoidable observations we could not help but make, both as engaged social researchers and activists, in the immediate wake of the great capitalist crisis of 2008. The first was that despite the undeniable material manifestation of the crisis in people's day-to-day lives across the Anglophone North Atlantic, radicalized mass movements were conspicuous in their absence. In their place, public discourse was quickly colonized by a stream of pundits and experts of various stripes seeking to revivify Keynesian social welfarism, zombie-like from the grave to which it had been consigned as a result of the end of the class compromise in the 1960s. Even as financial and social shockwaves of global proportions seemingly laid bare the glaring and unavoidable internal contradictions of capitalism as a system of accumulation by dispossession and materialized their brutal consequences in the day-to-day realities of people who had believed themselves to be relatively comfortable and secure, public discourse remained mired in the half-hearted attempts to preserve the status quo. For many self-described radicals and revolutionaries in the global north, a crisis like this one was long believed to be the thing that, all else failed, would light the spark on the revolution. Now the moment had arrived, and immobilization seemed more entrenched than ever. The second observation that struck us and others in this moment was that the manifestation of the crisis led not to socially just radicalization, but to a proto-fascist politics. Barely submerged social violences articulated along predictable axes of oppression, race, gender, sexuality, class, ability, age, status, and more, displaced the crisis and its hope for resolution onto the backs of those already most marginalized, oppressed, and exploited. Instead of solidarity, we witnessed a proliferation of social violence, with those perceived as outsiders or least able to contribute to a return to some pre-crisis moment deemed not only expendable but almost sacrificial upon the altar of heteropatriarchal and white supremacist capitalism. The third observation was that the great collapse of 2008 deepened and intensified the already profound crisis of social reproduction wrought by capitalist exploitation. Marxist feminist scholars and activists such as Maria Mize and Silvia Federici have demonstrated the centrality of the work of feminized, invisibilized, unremunerated social reproduction, that is, the labor that brings labor power into existence and which nurtures and sustains it, not only to capitalist accumulation, but to the forms of social life upon which we collectively depend. At the most obvious level, the massive and historically unprecedented transfer of public wealth to private hands that followed on the heels of the Great Collapse magnified already glaring inequalities and injustices in the realm of social reproduction, as already meager social safety nets were further shredded in the interests of continuing business as usual. At a deeper level, as with the intensification of the hatred of others that followed the Great Collapse, capitalist crisis provided an opportunity for the intensification of systems of exploitation and oppression aimed at all those who labor in the service of social reproduction, even as our capacity to reproduce ourselves, our labor power, and our social systems has become progressively more imperiled. Across the world, but exemplified in the Anglophone North Atlantic, endemic social crisis and collapse of the so-called middle class heralds not simply the end of an era of prosperity and security for some, based on unjust, hierarchical privilege, but an attack on the very capacity of society to bring itself back into being. The crisis of nearly every dominant institution, from public education to universities to government to healthcare to prisons, stands as a testament to the contours of this crisis. As we've noted in our work on the radical imagination, even as the promise of middle-class belonging has been extended to people previously excluded from it, women, racialized people, queer and trans folks, etc., the ability to actually secure its promises has never been less tenable. The myth of middle-class belonging remains a formidable obstacle to realizing radical social change, even as its realization recedes into impossibility. The fourth observation is very much connected to the third, but manifests in the context of movements for social justice themselves. In short, social movements are themselves racked by the crisis of social reproduction we bear witness to in society at large, even as they reproduce conceptions of victory, success, and failure that mirror rather than depart from norms generated by the very socioeconomic and political systems they purport to oppose. Social movements are not merely discrete vehicles for contentious or oppositional politics. They are spaces within which activists experiment with other ways of living and being. They are sites of prefiguration and social reproduction. But this desire to be radically other does not free them from reproducing toxic relations and notions of success and efficacy that replicate the norms of the exploitative and oppressive systems they confront, but within which their active members were themselves socialized. The reproduction of systems of oppression and exploitation within movements is a deeply troubling dynamic, commented upon by numerous scholars and activists. While the forces propelling this internalization of systemic injustice are complex, movements have often deferred addressing the perpetuation of oppression within their own spaces through recourse to more urgent or immediate set of concerns, crises, or struggles. Movements and their participants often claim they lack the time and space necessary to deal with systemic oppressions and the perpetuation of injustices within their own ranks in the face of a multitude of external crises demanding their urgent attention. This kind of rationalization, one which we encountered not infrequently in our own research in Halifax, ultimately endlessly postpones the work of coming to terms with these poisonous dynamics and perpetuates the very violences and injustices social justice movements purport to oppose. Too much activism in the age of austerity focuses on the crises of capitalism without making the necessary links to a host of other vital sites and urgent struggles. The consequence of this is not only political incorrectness, it's failure to build fierce, resilient, and powerful movements for social justice and social change capable of engaging people beyond our own already established and small circle of friends and comrades. Movements, in other words, are not merely vehicles for contentious politics arising from material conditions of crisis. They are complex ecologies that require the radical imagination if they are to matter. So what does all this mean for struggles not only against austerity, but against the systems of oppression and exploitation that organize and orient our lives? What does it mean for engaged research with social movements carried out in the spirit of solidarity? First and foremost, it means that rather than prioritizing questions about how to defeat the new cycle of capitalist accumulation by dispossession that has unfolded beneath the banner of austerity, movements and those seeking to work productively with them need to ask harder questions about the spaces and times of radical politics. Rather than fetishizing movement practices or models of struggle, chasing after a model of political efficacy modeled on dominant norms, or seeking to validate social movement activity in the eyes of the mainstream, what would it mean to sharpen and clarify some of the most vexatious issues within radical milieus without attempting to reconcile them? What would it mean not simply to make space for other subjects and perspectives and so retreat into a politics of tokenism and liberal inclusion, while the terms of the debate are already fully formed, but to make time within movements to address the reproduction of oppression and our notions of what it means to win? What would it mean for movements and activists to learn to live, as we all do at the level of our individual lives, not in the airy heights of victory or mired in the depths of defeat, but in the hiatus between them, in that mundane, unromantic, but essential space and time of social reproduction and persistence? What could come of a willingness to dwell in that hiatus with movements, not in order to wallow there, but to renew and reinvigorate a commitment to the long arc of social transformation? As we discovered in the course of the Radical Imagination Project, such conversations are not tangential to social justice struggle. They're central to it. Indeed, this is why the radical imagination matters. Not because it's the source of our radical transformative potential. In fact, the radical imagination is little more than a placeholder for that collective capacity to envision that which does not yet exist and to fuel the common action necessary to realize it. But because without it, we play only the game of the powerful, a game whose rules, terms, and objectives are set in advance regardless of how well we play. In this context, engaged research conducted in a spirit of solidarity with radical social justice struggles must do more than catalog movement successes and failures. It must do more than produce specialized knowledge for communities of experts far removed from the concrete terrain of struggle. It must instead seek to bring into being new ways of imagining and enacting social justice alongside those struggling for real, lasting, and profound social change. At a moment marked by limitless crisis, war, austerity, deepening inequality, social decay, and an ever-augmented repressive state apparatus, researchers and other intellectuals willing to offer ideological and technocratic fixes in defense of the dominant order and the elite interests it represents are now cast as public intellectuals par excellence. But as Janet Reutemann has so perceptively noted, declarations of crisis today are not simply descriptions of empirical realities. They are invocations of the powerful that serve to open up certain pathways for action while foreclosing others. In this sense, the trope of crisis has served as a powerful disciplining tool, reshaping the ways research, critical inquiry, and education are envisioned, valued, and practiced. Against research's technocracy in the Radical Imagination Project, we've attempted to chart an alternative approach to what a practice of solidarity research might look like. While it should be abundantly clear that the Radical Imagination Project is far from perfect, as an experiment in innovating an ethnographically based research method capable not only of documenting social movements and social change struggles, but actually engaging them, it has proven promising. More than this, our project has also demonstrated that it's possible to conduct engaged, committed research that participates in efforts to realize a better world without sacrificing academic rigor or our imperfect autonomy as researchers in so doing. Indeed, through this work, we fruitfully explored the utility of the weird and always unjust autonomy of the academy as a way to do research with social movements that contribute something to them that they're not already doing for themselves. In this sense, our project not only provided resources and neutral space for activists to have discussions they were not having elsewhere, it also intervened in the frenzied temporality of activism so frequently characterized by urgent mobilizations to defend against both the erosion of gains won and fresh attacks to the fabric of social justice. This slower space and time provided by our solidarity research allowed for critical moments of deep reflection and afforded the opportunity for activists to have conversations about big ideas that they felt they did not have the time or luxury for in the course of their day-to-day activities. This is hopefully not all solidarity research can do, but it's nonetheless a satisfying and useful place to start. The systematic forms of violence, inequality, and exploitation shaping our world today will not be solved through technocratic fixes or through the proper application of expert knowledge. In fact, if the latest convulsions of global capitalism reveal anything, it's that our systems of knowledge production and application have become far too enmeshed in the status quo and the dominant interests it reflects. What is needed then, at least in part, are approaches to critical research that seek not only to describe a given phenomenon, or ruminate endlessly on its complexity, but participate in facilitating collective grassroots ways of envisioning and ultimately materializing alternatives to systemic forms of oppression and exploitation. Critical and engaged research grounded in rigorous principled methods matters, perhaps now more than ever given the ideological mystifying nature of the ascendant right's assault on the basic principles of reason, justice, democracy, equality, freedom, and peace. And while it's not the only or even the most important piece of the social change puzzle, it has the potential to assist social justice struggles in ways that go beyond providing good information or reliable analysis. Today, we face a concerted attempt to enclose our collective imagination of the politically possible by those with vested interests in diminishing our capacity to envision and live otherwise. In the face of this, critical social justice research must not only help reveal structures and systems of violence, exploitation, and oppression, as well as those who benefit from their perpetuation and those who are consumed by them, it must also contribute to people's capacity to imagine and forge paths beyond them. Thank you.
Thank you, Max.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a panel discussion with Kostas Kornetis, assistant professor at the Center for European and Mediterranean Studies at New York University, and Alex Kuznabish, associate professor in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Mount St. Vincent University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Tonight's discussion was titled Social Resistance in Times of Austerity and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Study of Europe in collaboration with the Latin American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was Cornel Ban, assistant professor of international relations at Boston University. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.